During the summer of 2015, it's BYOS, Bring Your Own Sermon. Questions were submitted to me by my congregation, 25 of them in all, in which I distributed over 12 sermons. And this sermon on June 21st, 2015 is the first. The sermon is called A Lived Lamenting Faith, and the three questions I addressed are these. If there is no afterlife, what is there? You don't believe in afterlife, but would you tell a grieving person that their loved one is just dead and done? What would you say to them? In reading What You Believe, this no afterlife is the one I struggle with most. I agree with no heaven, hell places, or no God person, but I want to still believe that my loved ones are somewhere peaceful and happy and loved, or that their spirit is with me. I sense or believe in something, a creator that unites us all. Science has an important role, but did not give me love. Reading you has gotten me to focus on what I believe, good news, so I will ponder afterlife some more. On a lighter note, does belief in no afterlife mean no ghosts or spirits, so would you walk through a graveyard at night? The second question, how did the death of your son impact your faith? Yes, this would be one of my questions. Did the impact include changes or affirmations? Honestly, does such an event impact everything in your life? And finally, not believing in a supernatural God or heaven, how do you comfort people who are dying? So those are the three questions I took up in my sermon for June 21st, 2015, A Lived Lamenting Faith.
Most of the time when we go through life, we put on our game face, and we put on the uniform, and we put on the smile, and that's what gets us through. Underneath, it doesn't matter what we're feeling. And you learned this in radio. It doesn't matter what you like. You always got to get out there and smile and do the show. And that's a good skill to learn. The only thing about that skill is that we sometimes forget that it's a skill that we learn. And that there are times in which it's good actually to see what's there behind the mask. And that is the beauty, I think, of communities, faith communities, is that at their best, they allow for that time for people and that space for people to be able to take off the mask and to be real about their own lives. And part of this series of questions for sermons is allowing me to do that a little bit with you, to offer some of my own vulnerability. And so I'm going to go ahead and do that with some of these very tough questions, really tough, and in the sense that they are very personal. So I'll just go ahead and get right at it. It was 3 years ago, Father's Day, that we last saw my son, Zachary. The four of us spent the day together. We went to the movies at the $3 theater, the Reel to Reel in Johnson City. And we watched the classic film, The Dictator, by the Coen brothers. You don't need to look it up. It's the kind of film that my son and I would watch, but don't report that to the presbytery. We were happy. Both of our children lived nearby. We had a nice home. Our careers were going well. I had just started my radio show, a hobby of sorts, but fun and important to me. I was looking forward to being commissioner at the General Assembly in Pittsburgh. That morning, I started a summer sermon series on happiness. And I said in the sermon that I was about as happy in my life now as I had ever been. Things were going so well that I almost forgot about the dark cloud on the edge of the sky that had been churning for the previous 5 years. We had been on watch with Zachary. He had made a suicide attempt in his second year of college and had lived with us for most of the time since then. We couldn't figure out that magic formula that would remove whatever pain he felt within him. And he courageously fought it every day. Zach was an incredible human being. He was good-looking, funny, smart, kind. Everyone liked him, and we loved him. On June 28th, Beverly and I drove the six-hour drive through West Virginia to General Assembly in Pittsburgh, and while there that first night, we received the call that he was gone. And we drove back all night in tears and disbelief. That's the short version, and that's all I really need to say publicly. It's important for me that the universe knows that Zach's life was a beautiful gift to us, and we are grateful for him, and that makes his absence more painful. It's been 3 years. I still don't know if I'm grieving correctly. Not sure if I'm supposed to be grieving at all after all this time, right? Or what stage of grief that I'm in or should be, and I certainly don't want any advice about it. I never know how public I'm supposed to be about these things, and again, I'm not interested in opinions about that either. I am a husband, I'm a father to Zach, and to a beautiful, funny, smart, kind daughter, and a daughter-in-law, and actually, in a sense, father, not biologically, but in spirit, to my wife's youngest sister who lived with us, Michelle. In addition to all of that, I'm a minister, and being a minister is not just a job or a career for me. It is that. It is my job, it is my career, but it's a profession through which I live out my passion, and I'm fortunate to have that. The fancy religious word is calling, and while that word has its origins in supernaturalism, such as a call from God, nonetheless, I do consider what I do a vocation, and it is a privilege. And I recognize that, and I'm grateful for that. My calling, or my vocation, is that I seek to articulate experience and ask questions of meaning. And I protect that part of my work because as a pastor in a church institution, there's a great pressure to spend all my time on trivialities. But I consider my calling to be to assist people as they work out their own meaning through this walk of life. And I do this through sermons, through teaching, through writing, through whatever, radio, sharing a cup of coffee, visiting with folks, so forth. And I provide that background as kind of an introduction to this series of sermons on questions that have been brought to me by you, members of this congregation. And I'm starting with the hard personal questions that I had solicited in order to prime the pump for this series. And one of those questions that was asked was this: how has my faith and perhaps my calling as a minister been affected by the death of my son? I invited people to ask that question, and someone actually did ask it, so now I have to answer it. Okay. It's a hard question because I really don't know. I suppose that people who knew me before and after could observe changes in me, but I don't know what they see. I know that I've lost a lot of quickness. My memory isn't as good as it was, especially with names. And it's been a challenge, actually, to get to know you and your names and your stories. They kind of run together. So I appreciate your patience with me and repeating that with me. My energy level is certainly not where it was 3 years ago. I'm kind of like a baseball player who's lost a few miles per hour on the fastball, but compensates by being more cagey. Well, that's that part. My opinion on matters metaphysical have not changed on many things, but many of them have been validated by my experience in some ways. For instance, I've never liked celebrating Mother's Day and Father's Day in church. And I was sensitive to people for whom those days are painful. Before I experienced it. For instance, parents who had lost children. And it is true, now that I'm a member of that club, I just as soon stay home than to have to endure some big hullabaloo about all that in church. But losing a child has also given me a healthy cynicism about the whole thing, a dark humor. Well, whatever. I don't have to guess what a father or mother might feel like. I know at least what I experienced, and there's probably a resonation there. There is a sense in which I get it and can thus cut through a lot of the silliness faster when people are grieving. Let's skip the platitudes and go right to the feelings. And that leads to the question about how I might comfort grieving people if I personally don't believe in a supernatural God. And you know, I used to worry about that. I haven't really believed in a supernatural God for a long time, and I felt guilty about it. I thought that it might be because I hadn't suffered enough. If I was really suffering and grieving, I would need a supernatural God. And actually, it's been a relief of sorts. After my son's death, I have legitimately entered the sufferer's club, and thus I have a right to my own theology. And I've discovered the simple maxim: if a supernatural God is helpful to you, then great. If a supernatural God is not helpful to you, then great. And it really doesn't matter what anyone else thinks about it. It's your theology, it's your life, it's your view, and that matters. People who are grieving are on their own journey, and they will gather around them people they want as companions, grieving and or dying. And as far as my role as a minister is concerned, I'm there. I'm there for you. I'm there for anyone who really wants me there. I am a companion, and I can help articulate the experience. I can help bring out feelings and thoughts, be able to articulate what one's life, or help one to articulate what that life means to them. And those who did that were companions to me. Now, this may sound odd, but I don't see my role as offering comfort especially. In fact, a verse that appeared to me in bold, flashing print after Zach died was from Jeremiah. Thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. I don't think there's any more true text in the Bible than that one. She refuses comfort. Of course. All comfort is shallow. It's a joke. It's a triviality. It's a platitude. It's an insult. There is no comfort. I wanted no comfort. I didn't want any promises of heaven or caring deity or assurances of the light or that it will get better or I'll get through this. I wanted what was real. And what was real was lamentation and bitter weeping. That's real. I often said to myself, please don't cheapen my loss or my son's life with some phony booby prize of heaven or a pretend divine being. That sounds harsh, and that's what grieving is. It's harsh. I found that the desire for comfort comes not so much from the person who is grieving or dying, but from the friends of those who are grieving. And that's why the book of Job is so great. It's about the poor, bumbling, well-meaning friends of Job who want to comfort him. And what the amazing book exposes, of course, is that they are the ones who need the comfort. They can't bear to see him suffer so and be so ornery about it, so they offer him one platitude after another, one piece of advice after another, one piece of theological nonsense after another, so that they can feel some sense of protection from the void that Job knows all too well. Job must have done something wrong. But there is no protection from that void. It's part of life. You face it. You're changed forever by it. And if you're lucky, you take another step. In Barbara Brown Taylor's book, Learning to Walk in the Dark, she talks about a sunny spirituality that affects most communities. That's a spirituality that denies the void. It wants everyone to be happy or to get happy again as soon as possible. It does not recognize the holiness of lament. It sees lament as a temporary loss of faith. Chin up. Be happy. There's no crying in heaven. Or as Jimmy Dugan, the character played by Tom Hanks in A League of Their Own, says to one of his players, there's no crying in baseball. A sunny spirituality does not recognize that lament is a holy place. Rachel's lamentation and bitter weeping, her refusal to be comforted, is not a disorder. It's not the absence of God. It's a holy act. It's a sacred place. And those who are there in that place are witnesses to the holy. And those who are fortunate to be in their inner circle as companions on their journey, not comforters, but companions, are witnesses with them. And the void is also the place of holiness. And that's why neither Job nor Rachel need protection or comfort from it. They're asking of us simply to be heard. They are asking of us to be with them without comforting them, to be with them in that harshness, without turning away, and without trying to change them or pity them, but to hear from them an offer of a gift. My lamentation and my bitter weeping is holy. The void and the grief of it provides insight. It shouldn't be a surprise. Well, maybe it should be. But anyway, Christianity's central symbol is the Son of God on a cross. In Mark's gospel, the first person to get that Jesus is the Son of God is the centurion who sees him on the cross, and as Jesus breathes his last, as he dies, he says, "Oh, he's the Son of God." And Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" It's the voice from the void. It's a holy utterance. There's a wonderful sermon by Robert M. Price in the latest issue of the Fourth R, which is a publication by the Jesus Seminar. It doesn't publish many sermons, but it published this one. His sermon is entitled "The Holiness of Desolation," and I want to just read a couple of paragraphs for you from the end. Robert M. Price: "When the illusion of human self-sufficiency is gone, and nothing is seen but the ruins of weakness, then is the time when the power of Christ becomes conspicuous by its absence. It is like antimatter, if you know your physics. A positron appears for a split second and then decays, leaving behind it a charged hole where it was. When human strength decays after a brief moment of visibility, it leaves behind it a void that radiates the power of God. If you are in a frozen tundra of darkness and desolation, I charge you, do not imagine that God has abandoned you. The sunny days of religious feeling and spiritual ecstasies were a shiny temple, a fancy idol. Now you find yourself in the ruins, where true holiness may be felt in the depth of the soul's night or the body's pain. It's on the cross that you are God's son or daughter. Enter into the mystery of the terrible spirituality of the Lamentations. Cry out to him in your forsakenness. It may be some comfort to know that in so doing, you are closer to him than you've ever been. His invisible power and holiness shine the more brightly from your darkness." That was Robert M. Price, Holiness of Desolation in the Fourth R. The grief over the loss of my son has added an experience of depth, the holiness of lamentation and desolation. No, I don't think of God as a supernatural being. God is more interesting than that. God's more cagey, more invisible, seen, if at all, in desolation. Okay, last question, the afterlife. First of all, I know this topic is important for some. People have had experiences and they have beliefs, and I mean in no way to discount any of it any more than I would want mine to be discounted. But I will share my thoughts, take them for what they're worth. Here are a couple of provocative statements. Christianity is not particularly good at afterlife. It was mostly used as a promise that justice would eventually be meted out and to keep people behaving. Heaven and hell, and throughout Christian theology, most go to hell. Now, most of us have kind of let go of that one. And that's why people who are really after signs, proof, and hope that our consciousness will survive the death of our bodies find New Age philosophies more sympathetic. And there are many movements for those who are interested in that. Hinduism and its variants, of course, have reincarnation as a central doctrine. What most people in the West don't get is that reincarnation is not desirable. The goal is to end it. It's to get off the wheel. So the guru is ecstatic when he declares that it's been revealed to him that he only has as many lives left as there are leaves on that tree. And it's a big tree. How many leaves does a tree have? Well, the tragedy of birth and rebirth is that the damn thing won't end. It's going down to the MAC station every day, and you want to get on the train, and you keep missing it. Got to go through this again and again. I'm not sure if belief in an afterlife is really a solution to our existential problem. I don't insist. I don't care, really. In fact, I don't particularly like being told that my views are inadequate, or that I need to be saved, or that I'm going to hell. I find all that weird and superstitious. I also think that karmic consequences, or heavenly rewards, or hellish punishments can be forms of spiritual abuse, and they can be forms of legitimizing bad situations in the present. Okay. Now, if there is some way in which my consciousness will survive my death and I have an awareness of self in some other realm, hey, I'm game. But it really does nothing for me in terms of how I live my life currently in the present. As far as I think about it, if folks want to live forever, that's fine. I just think it's a lot more work. Again, this is one of those things I feel guilty about, because I didn't think I could suffer it enough, right? Losing my son should make me interested in life after death. And yet, my views didn't really change. I just no longer feel guilty about sharing them. Again, I don't insist. I can't possibly know. And I'm very happy if others feel differently. In fact, we could have great conversations about it. That'd be fun. Now, some might ask me, well, don't I want to see Zach again? Or isn't it comforting to know that he's watching or waiting? And actually, for me, no, it's not particularly comforting. I really don't want a ghost of him. I miss the real guy in flesh. I miss the way he smelled. And I had that. And now I have his memory. For what it's worth, I've developed a metaphor of my own. I call it the Great Peace. Zach has entered, as I will one day, the Great Peace. No worries, no joys, no sorrows, no divine punishments, no divine rewards, no anything. It'll be the same as whatever I experienced before I was born. It will actually be the same as what Hinduism and Christianity in certain forms promise eventually. After you go through all this heaven and hell, after you get spinning on the wheel, eventually you reach the point in which we drop into the divine like a drop of water is absorbed by the ocean. I affirm the Great Peace, which shortcuts all the extra lives in the heaven and hell and goes right to it. So the Great Peace is at the moment of death, the drop that re-enters the ocean. Everyone goes there, the saints and the wicked alike, which nobody likes because we want the wicked to have to go through the system. And that's that. I learned this from Presbyterians. I learned the good part of it. Justification by faith through grace. That's what it means. It means that it's grace. That no matter what, you belong. And that bums out the righteous. In the meantime, what I really want is not life after death. I want life before death. I want this life to be as real as it can be. And actually, Zach's death has highlighted that for me. I realize more than ever that life is precarious and precious. It's always far shorter than we ever expected. And if there's any sense of afterlife, it is that I want to live a life in such a way that what I've done will somehow impact the future in a positive way. I want to add my feeble works to what Joanna Macy calls the great ball of merit. And that great ball is a reality of its own. It's the interactions over the ages of humanity's aspirations and good deeds that will hopefully allow our species to survive and thrive for millions of more years. And adding to that great ball of merit is really all the afterlife I need. Again, I don't insist. Wherever you are is good for me. But I will close with this blessing from Henri Frédéric Amiel. Life is short, and we have never too much time for gladdening the hearts of those who are traveling the dark journey with us. Oh, be swift to love. Make haste to be kind.